I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, will YouTube dim the fire of preachers to the powerful? We'll talk about that in just a few minutes. But first, we go behind closed doors. That's our weekly segment where we talk about painful issues, things we often feel we have to keep hidden. Last week, Joanna Connors, a reporter for the Cleveland Plain Dealer, told us about how, 20 years later, being raped still made her feel powerless and ashamed. To fight those feelings, she decided to track down her attacker. She wrote a remarkable series of articles that told his story, as well as her own. And it reminded us that those feelings of being ashamed and alone can be magnified when the perpetrator is in a position of trust, highly regarded by the community, perhaps a family member. In the case of Erilyn Mills, it was all three. As a girl, she was repeatedly molested by her father, the Reverend James Bevel, one of the most brilliant and daring strategists of the civil rights movement, an icon. After years of failed attempts to draw the concern of family members, Mills pursued charges against her father, and in April, Bevel was convicted of incest. He's awaiting sentencing now. Recently, Mills shared her story in the Washington Post magazine, and she joins us now. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Your story was very painful to read. It must have been even more painful to tell. I wanted to ask why you decided that now was the time to tell it.
Well, in that it was going to be in the news, the story, this side of my side should be told. Having background is important to get the whole picture so you can assess it based on the truth or the facts in the matter and not just conspiracy, as my father had called it, as if it was a conspiracy against him.
We were corresponding about your coming on the program, and because I have to be honest, I was hesitant to contact you because mm-hmm. I was worried that you would see it as an intrusion mm-hmm. or as a burden to talk about something so painful again. One of the things you said to me was that the healing, growth, and happiness that my family and I experience needs to be shared. Those that suffer in similar or different ways need to know that they don't have to carry the burden of their trauma and pain for the rest of their lives. What helped you to understand that?
Well, it was in part my own experience when I left home at 16. And I went to stay with the Bruderhof, which is a Christian community similar to the Amish in Pennsylvania. And being there for 2 years, I was saturated in an environment where family values and just, you know, I grew up where there was a lot of talk about love and peace and happiness and family values. But when I was there, I actually saw it. And I realized that, one, that it wasn't just, you know, one way to live. There are other ways to live, and you could choose how you wanted to live your life. And when I left there, I began that process of deciding and designing how I wanted to live my life.
I mean, you were a very young girl mm-hmm. when the abuse started.
Right.
How did you become aware that this was wrong? Did you always know it was wrong? Did you always sense that it was wrong?
No.
Because you describe kind of a cult-like environment where you right. were all being, the children in the family, the women in the family were being kind of trained to accept a certain kind of behavior. You
know? Right. My childhood was isolated in terms of, I wasn't isolated in terms of I couldn't interact with people outside or I didn't go to school. But in terms of my father's teachings, he put this barrier between us and the world. And he placed himself in a position of being the person who was going to save the world. And he used his historical background in the civil rights as an example of, see what I did so far, I'm still doing that. So I grew up with a fear of society and of people and a great mistrust for the system and a great trust in my father. So I didn't feel it was wrong. And I remember in school they talked about good touches and bad touches, but the difference was I didn't trust the people in school.
What made you realize that it was wrong?
It was actually, as in the article, it was actually watching an Oprah show. And it was the difference in this was there was a little girl. And she was telling things that I experienced. And that connected to me. And that was pretty much the catalyst for my understanding that maybe it's not just me that feels uncomfortable. Maybe this is wrong.
And you did try to tell your mother what mm-hmm. was happening.
Mm-hmm.
How did she react?
The exact statement was that I spelled molest wrong. And
you wrote her a letter telling her what
right.
happened.
Because I always wrote letters. Mm-hmm. I wrote her I love you letters and, you know, this was my day letters and I hid them in her purse or in her shoes and things. So that was my way of communicating to her. And yeah, she dismissed it in that regard. She later, she asked me to recount a tale, some other women who were in the environment, what happened. And I didn't say anything to them, mainly because they knew, because they had either witnessed it or I'd witnessed them doing behavior, you know. So it was just, it was like, why? And my grandmother was also there, and I didn't want my grandmother to know. So,
how do you understand this as a, this kind of culture of acceptance of abuse of children, particularly by somebody who portrays himself as a freedom fighter, as a person who's fighting for human dignity? This is such a fundamental affront to human dignity to force sex upon a girl who's too young to consent, too young to understand what's going on, to abuse your position as the head of a household. How do you understand that?
Well, I don't understand it. One of the things that I was hoping for, and some of my siblings were hoping for when we started this process with my father, was that we could start to understand it. And we really wanted our father, based on who he is and his own understanding, to take that step, to look at himself, to begin to, if not challenge other men, first by challenging himself. That was our hope. But he wasn't ready to look at himself.
One thing I want to point out is that one of the reasons that you decided to move forward with pressing charges is that there was a young woman in the household, a young girl in the household mm-hmm. with your father at the time. Your parents' marriage had ended.
Right.
You'd moved on with your life, mm-hmm. but that there was another young girl there, another child he'd had through a subsequent marriage. I have to say, I think that is a powerfully courageous thing to do. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you see it that way?
I feel almost as if it's something I had to do, and it's something I had the support of so many people to do. Up until 2004, I had no idea that it happened to anyone but me, including my other sisters. And so I had moved on, and I had felt that my father perhaps, like it was my fault, you know, it was just me. And when I got the confirmation from other siblings that it happened to them as well, it was something I had to do.
How many siblings do you believe were abused by your father? How many of your sisters?
There are eight girls, and I think all of us were abused in some way or another. And unfortunately, not all of us are able to see the abuse, even things that are obvious.
You confronted your father at one point, and you described this, I don't know what words to use. It was almost like a trial atmosphere. He decided that you should put him on trial, and then he defended himself in this, I don't even really know how to describe it. How would you describe it? This kind of pseudo-philosophical, I'm not even sure how would you describe it?
It is hard to describe because it's part of the whole environment that we lived in terms of having meetings to discuss problems. And he played the role of judge and jury in these meetings. But this was a meeting in which we called other members of the community, Bernard Lafayette and Rose Sanders, and as well as relatives, his brother, and we were all present, either on the phone or live. And
some people would call that an intervention. Do you think that's what it was?
Yeah, it was
like an intervention.
It was like an intervention, but for my father, it was a meeting. It was a, you know, you present your case, I'll present my case, and we'll decide what to do as a family. And it just didn't work because he reverts back to his role as the leader or the person who has to teach and help everybody to understand his perspective.
So in his world, he decides what's true and not true. He decides what's right and not right.
Yeah, that could be summed up like that. Yeah.
Do you think he's mentally ill?
I don't. I don't think he's mentally ill. I think he's more like a spoiled child in which he has been doing and being the way he is for so long that he gets away with it.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Erilyn Mills. She is the daughter of James Bevel, who was recently convicted of molesting her when she was a child. She's telling us her story of rape and recovery. One of the reasons you pressed charges, it was decided that you would press charges, is that the statute of limitations in Virginia, which is where these acts took place, allowed him to be prosecuted. And in order to make the case in the absence of physical evidence, which had long since disappeared, because you had grown up and moved away from the being in the zone of harm, is that you confronted your father in a recorded, monitored conversation with law enforcement where you confronted him about his behavior.
Right.
Okay.
And it's an hour and a half of him explaining his position. And you can listen to it for, you know, over and over again, and it won't make sense. But it's this idea that he was teaching all his daughters to look at the evils in the world and within men, whatever, whoever the man was, whether it's your father or the guy next door or your husband, but that you have to come to some understanding of what sex is outside of pleasure, that it's supposed to be only for procreation. And you have to be forced to see that, just like you have to be forced to accept nonviolence by getting beat. You know, he would make that kind of analogy. It doesn't necessarily make sense.
I think it's fair to say that you, your other siblings, went through a very great deal.
Mm-hmm.
You still found the strength to get together to try to rescue this younger sibling who was still in harm's way, according to what you had experienced. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of people who would have run in the other direction,
right,
who would have just said, look, I'm gone. I can't deal with this. I don't want to live that anymore. I don't want to relive any of that.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of people who didn't go through what you went through who would not have been able to do what you did. And I am wondering how it is that you and your siblings, you particularly, were able to do it. Do you have any idea where you were able to find that within yourself to do this?
Well, first of all, I had that feeling, too, that I didn't want to touch it, that I've moved on with my life. I had a son at the time, and I just had a daughter, but I just wanted to move on. And what really helped me was the fact that I had such a support system. I would not have been able to do that without my other sisters. One, their own stories, each of them being able to tell their stories to me and for us to share. And then also for us to go together, because we didn't grow up together. We didn't know each other, really. And we were just getting to know each other. But I didn't know how difficult it would be.
What was the hardest part?
The hardest part was learning of everyone's story. That was very hard for me, particularly my one of my little sister, not the youngest one that was in the household, but particularly her, because I had sought to protect her, and I was always buffering between my father. I never let her be alone with him, and I would always tell her the things that he did to me and what he would say if he got a chance to do it to her, and she always told me, "No, he doesn't do that to me. I have a wonderful relationship with my dad." And when she told me that everything I told her about was happening as I was telling her, that really hurt me. That really made me feel not just powerless, but that what can you do? What if we remove my little sister from the environment, and what if she decides to go back when she's 17 or 18 to see her dad and he does the same thing and she gets wrapped up in his spiel? What if that does happen? I mean, my little sister was 14 at the time, but you know, what if, you know, what can you really do? So I really felt powerless. And my sisters, and my brothers also, you know, because my brothers were also stood behind us 100% and said, you know, we have to do something.
How do you feel now?
I feel at peace with this whole process in terms of I'm happy that we stood on something and we followed it through. We all sought to press charges in different environments, and Virginia was the only one that was able to. And my little sister, who had a more recent experience in Chicago, she could have, but she could not talk. She could not share it. She was not able to deal with it.
Sounds like you would have made a hell of an organizer.
Perhaps. Mm-hmm. And it's the beginning, because and our next step is to really continue to work on. Part of it is brainstorming of how do you protect children within the home. No one wants the government in their home, but what options do they have? I mean, I remember being afraid of being taken from my home if I, you know, that was an option, that I could be leave, then I would have to go to stay at a foster home. And I had these horrible images that foster homes would be worse, and I never see my brothers and sisters again. And so what are the options for children? Who can they turn to? Who's watching their backs? And then things that I never understood is parents. I don't understand how parents violate their children anyway, realizing their children are going to grow up and they're not going to forget. And I always thought that was odd, and you know, people would do something that's not going to be forgotten. And it could come back to them pretty harsh. They could go to jail for this, and I never understood that.
Have you spoken to your father since the trial?
I haven't spoken to him since the trial. And actually, during the trial, he had come out the courtroom, and he had met my daughter. He was looking at her and talking about her and, you know, being his jolly self. And I actually got really, really sad because I realized that, you know, I won't be able to experience him anymore, as and that, you know, that my children, because my son knows his grandfather, and he knows Martin Luther King, and is, you know, very respectful of him. He doesn't understand the whole dynamics that's going on now. But, you know, I was sad because I knew that he wouldn't be a grandfather. And I wanted so much for him, not just to be a grandfather for grandfather's sake, but for him to find healing in himself and to come to some peace in himself so that he could be a grandfather and father.
Is he appealing?
Is he appealing?
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe so.
So he's going to jail?
Yes.
Your father's name is one that appears in many, many history books.
Mm-hmm.
This information, his behavior is now also part of history.
Mm-hmm.
How should we think about those two James Bevels?
I mean, we have to look at a lot of aspects of life in those parallels. We have a great country we live in that had slavery. How do we look at this country with these two dynamics? And we have to find a way because they exist. We are not just, you know, one way all the time. That's not to excuse the extremes in which people go, but it's an understanding, you know, and we try to stay on one side of what we think is right and good. I think the hardest part is not choosing a side to work towards and sticking to it.
Erilyn Mills tells her powerful story of rape and recovery in the pages of the Washington Post magazine. We will have a link to it on our website. She was kind enough to join us here in our Washington studio. Erilyn Mills, good luck to you. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.